Glad you're here. It's going to be a great day. Did you know that this is a thing?
What did we talk about that was that?
Made me feel all the feels.
There is a group hug coming here in just a minute.
That's amazing. Welcome to The Lisa Show. I'm Lisa Valentine Clark.
And I am Richie T.
The news of all the anti-Asian bigotry around the country has been hard to take this month. Coming up in 20 minutes, we're going to learn how we can use our voices to make a difference and help everyone feel safe.
And it is very likely that you, that's right, you are going to be watching Jeopardy in the near future.
What?
But you don't have to take my word for it. I'll tell you more about that coming up in your Morning Buzz.
Everyone knows the power that an upbeat song can have in boosting our mood. But did you know that there's just one word or small sound that can have the same effect? And I wanted to ask you, because as a DJ, you know how to change the mood of an audience.
Yes.
Depending on the occasion. And I wonder if that sort of wears on you in the sense that, like, when you come home and you're like, I need to cheer up, mm-hmm. or I need to go running, or I need to have a little boost, if it has the same effect on you.
Does it make it that much harder because sometimes those songs I would lean on to make myself in a better mood are also songs that, because they've been played so many other occasions,
yep.
that it's hard to attach? Yes, absolutely. It is interesting, the power of music.
And now, give me an example, because you do this a lot, and I'm sure all of us are thinking, okay, you know, when I need to be in a good mood, I need to change the scenery a little bit, then I'll turn on this, you know, this is my go-to song. But can you see that visibly as a DJ?
Yes. So I should say this power is great.
And with, really?
And you have to treat it with a lot of respect. It actually is a pretty funny thing. So rather than talking maybe about the upbeat part, although I know I want to have that part of this conversation,
okay.
I think the most illustrated way that I see this is when you have that moment for the father-daughter dance at a wedding.
Oh, okay. Like that has the biggest impact.
The first two notes of a song are where you watch everyone go, oh, they're going to...
everyone within, cries.
Within
not
just
a dry
like
eye
the,
in the house.
The first, like, bump, bump of a song.
That
as soon
quickly.
As soon as... It's almost like name that tune for your emotions. It's like... Am I going to be? Yes, I'm going to cry with this within just a couple of seconds within that. And so the same thing can be sort of seen, like, once you kind of come out of that. Typically, that would be when you play your first song in your wedding set and noticing exactly how people's mood changes, where it's like, and now it's time to dance. Let me have the dance floor. And they sort of take over. But without a doubt, you can see people's physical body language change, their facial expressions, their mood, almost, and I don't know any sort of science behind this mm-hmm. necessarily, but you can feel like the air in the room completely change from like, that was the sweet moment, now this is the fun moment, or the party moment, now it's the serious and we're sending mm-hmm. them off and saying goodbye moment. It can construct an entire evening.
I don't think it's something that we consciously think about a lot, but if you spend time, you know, going to movies and watching TV shows, it's the same thing. It's the music is the cue for the emotion. If there is something that you want to cue the audience to feel, you start with the music, or you emphasize it with the music.
Sure, but if you feel it too much from the music,
yeah.
then you feel sort of manipulated or pandered, right?
Yeah.
Like if
yeah.
you're watching a
that
show and you're like, okay, mm-hmm. here comes the whatever
they
the
want
thing
me to
is.
Cry.
Exactly. Or the bad, you know, moment is going to happen. If it's too obvious, we sort of, I think we sort of reject whatever that moment would be.
So the other day I was going on a run and I just was not feeling it, right?
Yeah.
And I was going up a hill and I just had a little bit left, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the songs that were coming on my playlist were not,
not doing it.
And I knew enough, just subconsciously, that I'm like, I got to find the song. I got to find the song that's going to get me home
mm-hmm.
Because I just need a little bit of motivation. And I, you know, kind of scrolled through my playlist and found one that was just going to like, was going to do it. And I was like, nope.
Nope.
Yep. That was it. Even just the first couple of notes got me on the rest of the way. And I wonder, what is the science behind that?
And I just envision you tackling this big hill in your neighborhood, and you're like, how do I get to Survivor's Eye of the Tiger? Come on, I need to summit this hill.
Well, did you know that one word or small sound can have that effect, not just a song?
Interesting.
According to a German study, certain sounds or words we say can actually have a positive effect on our mood. So it's not just about music. It could be about the sound of it. And because of what the words mean, but it's not that. It's simply because they sound good to our mind. And we wanted to explore this idea to find out what it is about a sound or a word that can boost our mood. So we're inviting into our conversation Professor Valerie Fridland, whose work focuses on the connection between language and society. And she joins us today to discuss the mind-mouth connection. Welcome, Valerie. Valerie, do we have you there?
Sounds like we may need to connect with her.
So another idea that I wanted to bring up was when my husband was studying theater in his master's degree, they explored this idea on how it affected stage performance. So he would go on the stage kind of at Old Globe. In London, and they I know. Do you like how I dropped that? I had to laugh before I said it.
Let me pick
you know,
up
the Old Globe in London. Yeah, have you heard of it?
Let me pick that up. Hang on one second.
And they explored as part of his studies the note that they would. It's called your true note. Mm-hmm. Like what sort of. It's not just the tone of your voice, but also the pitch and the intensity of it that is, quote unquote, your true note. It's to explore how you can use your voice in order to express emotion better. And so I thought that was really interesting because I know that it has different applications in different fields. I think we have Valerie here. Valerie, are you there?
Yes, sorry. Somehow I was disconnected, but I'm happy to be joining the conversation.
Well, we're glad that you're here. And this is such an interesting idea to us, the connection between mind-mouth, right? Between language and society.
Right.
How is it that sound affects our mood?
Well, I know we don't normally think about sounds very much, right? We think about words carrying meaning. So if I say dog, it's because I know those three sounds come together to mean that cute little furry thing that, you know, is in your house and eats your food. But what if the just saying duh or guh is actually part of what makes you adore the dog? So it's a theory called sound symbolism, and it's really a fascinating theory because it's not a new theory. Mm-hmm. It's actually been discussed by Plato, this idea that we have sort of words that capture the essence of what something is, not in any arbitrary way, but actually because there's something about that word that explains something about that person. Of course, they didn't develop the theory well back then, but in the 20th century, around 1920s, people started to do experiments with different sounds and see what the reactions were. And so what they found was certain sounds seemed to produce certain ideas and also certain feelings. So it's not only about emotion, although that's a big part of it. It also helps you decide how big something is, the shape it is. We've found all sorts of interesting connections with sounds.
Well, so is this the same thing as like an onomatopoeia where the sound actually describes the word?
It is actually very good. I'm going to give you the linguistics early morning award. It is.
Oh, thank you.
I want you to know we challenged her. I said, "Listen, there's a cool 20 in it for you today, Lisa. If you work in somehow in the show onomatopoeia." So, congratulations to both of you.
I'm impressed. And you get the award too. I see you both have the bet going on. Who can say it without messing up, right?
Right.
It is. That is actually one sort of more obvious form, right? So it's sort of graded, right? So onomatopoeia would be something that is, okay, the whole word sounds like the object's noise. But this is more not about what the noise sounds like as much as the motor skills that is used to perform it. So it's not that E means happy. It's that E makes us take a muscular position that's very similar to smiling. And there is a hardwired connection between that position of our musculature and our knowledge that we're usually happy when we say that, when we have that face. So it's sort of, it's called the facial feedback hypothesis, which is more about how your face is being positioned because you're saying E than the sound of the sound.
So then my mind immediately thinks there's got to be some specific words that if we're feeling down, maybe it would sound ridiculous. But if we say them
like
out loud, it can't help but make us feel better.
Yes, I can't say that I'm going to have your family think that you're not weird if you're doing this.
Yeah, sure.
Too late.
Yeah.
Ship sailed.
You should be able to say E. You actually don't even have to say a word because it's not the word. It really has nothing to do with the meaning of the word.
Yeah.
We get very tied because we're always thinking of words meaning things. Here, the idea is that sounds convey meaning just on their own. So in that experiment, there have been a lot of experiments. This is actually a pretty well-studied phenomenon. But in the experiment, they had subjects say either E, 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 E about once every second or O, 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 O about once every second while they rated cartoons on how funny they were. What they found is when people said E, 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 E while they were rating cartoons. So again, yes, you may want to do this in an isolated place. They thought those cartoons were a lot funnier. So when they said, oh, 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 which if you make that noise, think about how your face is structured, right? If you say, oh, 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 it's kind of a frowny face or a pouty face, which we normally do when we're not super happy. And so, again, that muscle connection seems to be trained into us so that we consider ourselves less happy when we're having that face. And that's why when we say, oh, which is the vowel it's been most found with, but also some other back vowels like ooh, that we start to feel less happy or depressed. And so they found that those subjects that said, oh, 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 actually performed less well on that test. They would say it was not as funny.
Or
they'd make up more words that were less happy.
We're talking with Valerie Filinda about the mind-mouth connection, and I wish, Valerie, that you could see Lisa.
I'm playing along.
She's working through these different sounds off mic, and you just kind of see her going, ee, and she's smiling, and then she's like, oh, and then she's working through the other ones that you haven't mentioned yet, and it's like, ooh, and I'm like, are you okay? Do I need to call someone?
Think of the benefit your facial muscles were getting. So it's exercise and a better mood.
I like that.
Lisa's on to something.
See? We're helping your facial structure, boosting your mood at the same time. We're saving you time, money. I love it.
See, there's a reason why there's an E in beauty.
Yeah, that's funny. Is this the same idea as listening to certain kind of music to boost our mood? Is this instinctive in us and now we just have the science to back it up?
Well, you know, that's interesting because that's what Darwin hypothesized. This theory was actually something that was also hypothesized by Darwin, saying that we actually imitate sounds in our environment and it changes how we think about those sounds or what they mean to us. And that's why there's this iconic relationship between what we sound like and what it means, because it's actually a natural sound, which is sort of what Plato was discussing when he was talking about Socrates' own view of sounds and meaning. So yes, in many ways, it could be partially related to that. There are theories. That's a separate theory than the one the German researchers were researching, but there are theories that it's actually a hardwired connection from, you know, way back when we were just sort of starting to listen to noises and starting to imitate them. And then the feelings those noises gave us or the emotions there were in the environment were the ones that we copied with them.
Wow. And do these same...
I like your examples of music, because I think music is a good example.
Do the same kind of sounds and words have this a similar effect on everyone?
That's what's crazy is this has been found to be universal. So it's not just in English because, again, it's the sounds, not the meaning of the words. And what's really different between languages is not the sounds. Although, I mean, some languages do have a different inventory, but almost all of them have high front vowels, which is what makes you happy. And so this kind of sound symbolism research is often done on languages other than English. In fact, it's hard to find English research. And all of them find very similar findings. Not just that you get happier when you say E, but also, for example, if you say ooh, that we tend to think of things as being round. So if you name an object as a brand consumer, you know, if you're doing marketing, you name a round object, something with a round vowel, people actually tend to buy it more. Hmm. Or if you name something that's round with a round vowel, people remember it better, which is obviously good if you're branding something. Yeah, so there's a lot of really fascinating research that's universal in languages.
If we use it or we tend to rely on this too much, can we sort of use it up? If we use up our E and constantly rely on it, could it then in fact no longer have that impact?
Could your E backfire?
Yeah, a backfiring E, yeah.
I guess no, probably not. I think, you know, it's subtle. It's a very, very, very subtle relationship at this point. You know, most of the research suggests that the strong form of this theory, that if you run around saying E all the time, you're just going to be so gleefully happy you can't help yourself, is probably not true. Because
right.
There's a lot. There are a lot of things that factor into your mood, like, you know, how your children behaved or how your day is going, or if that person cut you off on your way to work. You know, those things actually probably have a greater effect. But what you could do is try to use E sort of to calm yourself, to make yourself happier. For example, when you're in the car and someone's cutting you off, if you don't mind, you know, chanting E, there is some research that suggests it might make you feel happier. You know, we also, one way that this might be useful is we find that, for example, in writing, even if you don't speak the language of the writing, if we hear it, we can often tell just from the vowel sounds, which is fascinating to me, whether it's a sad poem or a happy poem.
Wow.
So there's some idea that maybe this would help us diagnose depression or depressed individuals, you know, or people in manic depressive modes, that they would use more E in sort of the manic mode. So there are some really interesting applied benefits that might be more helpful than just if I, you know, say a lot of E, I'll be happy.
And now my kids are going to ask me why I'm muttering around the room. Mom's lost it again. No, I'm not. I'm taking control of my happiness.
Right. Right.
You know
exactly.
The game. You just don't tell anyone why you're doing it. And then they're like, are you okay?
Right.
We've been visiting with Valerie Fridland, who is a professor and former director of graduate studies in the English department at the University of Nevada, Reno. She focuses on the connection between language and society, which you can learn more about on her website, which is valeriefridland.com.
What can we do to make sure that everyone feels welcome and safe? Well, we're discussing that next.
And one of your favorite childhood actors may be coming to a Jeopardy stage near you. Well, I mean, like near your TV. Like, you'll watch it on TV.
Yeah, for sure.
I'll tell you who that is coming up in your Morning Buzz. You're listening to The Lisa Show.
Welcome back to The Lisa Show. Have you ever wanted to try rock climbing but felt kind of intimidated by it? Well, don't worry. In 20 minutes, we're going to tell you how you can get started at any experience level. But first, it's time for your Morning Buzz with Richie T.
It's three things that are trending online right now. People are talking about these things. This first one from the YouTube channel Mr. Beast. I love it. It's probably one of the ones that I will frequent the most very often. They are feeding an entire city, and I thought that was worth noting.
Really?
Yeah, 28,000 folks.
Oh, my word. So not a small township.
Now, did I say township?
No, you didn't.
Did I say village? Nope. Feeding an entire city, they said.
What's on the menu?
They got the peanut butter, and they've got the non-perishable food items. They've got a box of coconut water as well, but they partnered with a food bank because there are a lot of food insecurities across the nation right now, especially as people are still, you know, getting back to work, etc. The need is greater now more than ever. And they contacted the food bank and they said, hey, we're going to help out. And then they said, nah, you know what, let's just feed everybody in the city. And so they decided to do that.
They always do.
I love when YouTube channels will do that as opposed to the other one that I watched this morning that was like, we're moving. Aren't you sad for us that we're moving from mansion to another mansion? It's a It's a thing and not trending online.
Okay.
Also, today is National No Housework Day, so I hope you'll survive, Lisa, because I know that part of
I don't have to celebrate every holiday that we talk about.
I just checked. You have to celebrate this one.
Like nobody should do it?
Like no housework.
Who came up with that? There's going to be chaos.
For a day? For a day?
All right.
Lisa.
Okay.
Lisa.
All right.
For one day, do something else. Hang out with your kids. Go sit and have a drink. Maybe watch some television. Eat some coffee cake. Or you can get yourself some health insurance. That's the recommendations.
What?
All the things that you normally
I've
are
been putting off getting health insurance because I'm too busy cleaning my house.
Exactly.
This is how
exactly.
this works.
Exactly.
Who was this
Put
list
down
made
the coffee
for?
Cake. Let's get some health insurance.
So specific.
Listen, it's just what the day says, and you don't have a choice.
Okay.
No housework day. Get that health insurance you've been waiting for. And then finally, LeVar Burton, the internet demands that LeVar Burton be given a chance to host Jeopardy.
Butterfly in the sky, right?
Yeah. I know. We instantly were going to go through the entire song because take a look, it's in a book, a reading rainbow. There are several people that want him to do it as his Star Trek Next Generation character, Jody LaForge, with the thing across his
eye. That's great.
Doesn't matter. The world demands that LeVar Burton be given the chance to host Jeopardy. So maybe coming to a screen near you. Who is the greatest host of Jeopardy? That is your Morning Buzz.
Thanks, Richie T. Now, over the past year, we've watched as division in our world has reached new and dangerous heights. One such example is the rise in anti-Asian hate since last year. And our hearts go out to our Asian brothers and sisters, and we hate to see any sort of violence perpetrated against them. Yet sometimes it feels like nothing we do will ever be enough to really solve the issue and many others that we see occurring every day. But is that true? Our next guest would disagree with you. She believes our voices do matter and we can make a difference. So today we have Tricia Broke, a New York City human rights activist, here to talk with us about how we can use our individual voices and personal stories for good. Welcome, Tricia.
Lisa, Richie, thank you so much for having me. And it's actually Brooke. People get thrown by
Brooke.
That you in my last name.
Yeah. Well, thank you for that. Since March 2020, there was an increase of 149% in acts of hate targeting Asian Americans. How significant is this increase from the previous year?
I don't have the stats. What I do know, though, is that using language is powerful, and when we are unconsciously speaking hate into the world, that's why these statistics increase. And that is something that I think is very, very powerful and that we need to be aware of as people who are using our voices.
As we look across the country, is this happening in specific areas, or is this something overall that we need to look at comprehensively?
I think we absolutely need to look at this comprehensively. Race is a system that our country was built on. Racism is the system that our country was built on. And it's our responsibility to have conversations like this, Lisa, because it's not about perfection. It's about being in action. And if we can start talking about race, if we can start talking about our differences and the similarities that we have as human beings, that's why I think by speaking out, by being in these conversations, we can actually make a difference. And again, it's not about perfection. It's about asking questions. How am I part of the problem and how can I be part of the solution?
I'm gonna pause real quick because this is something that for me, like, I want to be a voice for change and for love and for acceptance. And there is the teeniest amount of anxiety, Tricia, that when I want to speak out on this or I want to be a help, that I'm going to say the wrong thing or that I'm going to, you know, immediately step out and realize, oh, I shouldn't have done that, or learn along the way and quickly be exposed. How can people that feel similar to me be able to eliminate those fears, or at the very least sort of quell them so that we can have more of these conversations?
I love this question, Richie, because it is about being exposed and it is about being willing to be criticized and to make mistakes. And that is the permission that I want to try to give people, is that have the conversation, be humble, be curious, and be willing to ask your brothers and sisters, brown brothers and sisters, Asian brothers and sisters, what can I do so that you know I am going across the street to stand with you and beside you and for you? And that's what being an ally is about. It's about being in action, and it's about asking questions. Let me just clarify, it does not mean asking our black friends to teach us about racism. That is our responsibility. But I think you're absolutely right, is that there's so much concern and fear about doing something mm-hmm. wrong that inaction is happening, and that is a big problem. We must be in action, even if it's imperfect.
Something that you've really emphasized in your work is the fact that everyone has a story to tell. Talk a little bit more about that and explain us how sharing our stories can be very uniting.
Well, in my book, The Influential Voice, Saying What You Mean for Lasting Legacy is just about that. And when we have the courage and the understanding of how to tell our story, and then we have the courage to tell our story, we literally can change and even save a life, because there are 7.8 billion people on this planet. One person is meant to hear what you have to say. And that's why the power of speaking is so important. That's why the power of having these conversations and sharing your personal story, your vulnerable truth, is going to impact the world.
We're visiting with Tricia Brooke about using your voice to speak up against hate. Specifically, we've sort of couched this in the idea of Asian hate here in America. I would be curious, how much is it important for us when people do try and speak out and be an ally, as people will make those mistakes or kind of fumble and learn through, to allow them the grace? An example that I would see is that, you know, sometimes people will speak out online, and if they don't get it exactly right, people will instantly, especially in a social media culture, get on and sort of shame them back to being quiet. How can we change that so that people can publicly make these sort of mistakes but be able to learn from them?
I think it's really important to be willing to be criticized, be willing to get negative feedback, because it's going to come. And if you become someone who is referred to as a white savior on social media, be sure to be authentic, speak your truth, and also be conscious that posting once on Instagram Black Lives Matter is not being in action. It is not being an ally. It is very important that you understand, if you're going to step into the role of being an influential voice and really being in action as somebody who believes in human rights and equality, you must do it every single day. And again, back to being imperfect. Mm-hmm. It's about having the conversations and modeling so that other people can see it's possible and they have less fear around it.
You know, there's so much hatred sweeping the nation, and we see these incidents of violence and hatred all of the time. If this is, not our issue, but we want to help, you know, if this is something that we need to be educated on ourselves and not to educate others, what are those things that we can do to be a real ally and not just someone who, you know, posts something on social media every once in a while, but actually has that point of action?
It really goes back to asking questions. How can I help? How can I support your community? What can I do to speak out on your behalf? Nydia Hahn, who is an Emmy Award-winning journalist in Philadelphia at ABC, she wrote the foreword to my book, and she literally reached out on social media asking for help with Asian hate crimes. And so that is the kind of courage and conversation that I'm talking about. She asked for help, so I helped her. I posted, I shared, I did an entire Facebook Live about Stop Asian Hate. And it's being conscious, it's paying attention, it's being in conversation and really asking the question, how can I help you? Do you need my support? And if you do, what does that look like?
What a great, powerful example. What else are you seeing across the country of these calls for help being answered that you have found to be really significant?
Well, conversations like this, Lisa, being able to come on your show and talk about really hard stuff. I had a conversation with Elizabeth Wellington from the Philadelphia Inquirer about hate and racism. And I'm seeing more and more people ask the question, can we talk about it? Are you comfortable? Are you willing? And what does that look like? And those questions are very triggering. And being able to trust that your heart is in the right place and that you are doing everything you can to be curious and to have humility around a conversation that is so complex, that is how we start change in this country.
Is it something, do you feel like if we noticed people in our lives that are maybe not so good at this or are stirring up hate, is it something that people will come to themselves to recognize that they're doing? Or is there a responsibility of calling that individual out? And if that is our responsibility, how would we call those individuals out?
Great question. I think microaggressions exist without anybody even knowing about it. And I think when you are in a situation where you hear someone saying something offensive, ask them the question first. Are you aware that this is offensive? Are you aware that this is racially charged or a racial slur? And if they are not, highlight that it is and why, and ask them to consider using different language. Also, first ask permission. Are you open to a conversation about race with me right now? Hmm. And that's going to give you the information you need.
It's such a great way to approach it. I think a lot of times our hesitancy to do or say anything is, I don't know what to do, and I feel like I'm stepping into this uncomfortableness, which, you know, we as humans will do anything to avoid, right?
Right.
And really, for sure, the impact of being able to have an uncomfortable conversation, the benefit can really spread and can be so positive. But getting over that initial uncomfortableness, I think, is what keeps a lot of people, especially if they feel like, oh, this doesn't affect me, from doing it. You talk a lot about being humble and curious and asking, what is it that I can do, and being in action. I'm wondering if in the next few minutes that we have remaining, if you will feel comfortable sharing some examples of people who have been able to do that and highlighting the impact that they've really have been able to have.
Well, I think Brené Brown does an excellent job at having hard conversations with people on her Dare to Lead podcast. And she recently had a conversation with Ibram Kendi. And he says, you know, racism is raining down all the time and white people don't even know they're wet. Mm. So I think that we have this systemic problem in our country that people have ignored, or that they have labeled themselves as not racist because ... Mm-hmm. And that is why this conversation is so important. And that is why having it with as many people as possible is so important. And I think Brené Brown does a great job. I think that you all having me on this show is a great example of being in action as allies. And just continuing, Nydia Hahn is a great example of someone who talks about race in a very, very passionate and also powerful and impactful way. She is all about change. So I think, you know, highlighting, following, learning from people who do this with that humility so that you can learn from them and then model like them is a step in the right direction.
And speaking of a step in the right direction, like, I feel like we make some progress in this. Like, if you look at the issues from last summer with Black Lives Matter, like, I feel like there was attention that was paid to that and that we've made some positive progress. But then we see in the last few months with this Asian American hatred and those things. From your perspective, is this a thing that, although not nearly finished, that we are in fact getting better, or is it we're getting better in some places and worse in others, and then those are just sort of switching out?
I wish I could say I think we're getting better. I think that we have a long way to go, and it's going to require everybody rolling up their sleeves and getting serious about this. And it comes back to language. It comes back to accountability, and it comes back to being conscious of the words you choose to speak into the world.
such a power that we all hold, and knowing that we have an impact in our homes and in our own lives, and we need to really focus on that cumulative effect.
And it can go out to your community and beyond. We've been visiting with Tricia Brooke, who is an international award-winning director, New York City human rights activist, and author of the number one new release on Amazon, The Influential Voice, Saying What You Mean for Lasting Legacy. If you want to learn more about her and her work, you can head over to her website, which is TrishaBrooke.com. I'm going to spell Brooke because it's different than what you think. It's B-R-O-U-K, TrishaBrooke.com.
Are you looking for a new hobby? Well, we're coming up next. We're going to tell you everything you need to know before going rock climbing.
You're listening to The Lisa Show. Welcome back to The Lisa Show.
Walking into any rock climbing gym for the first time can be really intimidating. Sometimes it sounds like the people there are speaking a different language. Like, if I say this to you, Richie, do you understand what I'm saying? Chalk is your friend.
Yep. I always like to walk into a gym and go, belay on! I just know that's the thing you say when you go to a rock climbing gym.
How about, I just really want a red point, a 12A. Someone wrote this down for me, by the way. I don't know what that means.
That's what I think.
Well, once you become part of the rock climbing world, and you're in, and you know the lingo, right, and the culture, you join a tight-knit community ready to really help one another out. I don't think that if you went into a rock climbing gym and yelled out any of those things, no one would leave you hanging.
Yeah, no, they'd get you.
Yeah, they'd have your back.
Yeah, of course they would.
So how do you get started? Because that could be really intimidating to start a new hobby, especially one that like requires a lot of safety equipment, in my opinion.
Yeah. Yeah, getting into a hobby that you could die if you do it wrong.
Well, don't say that.
Well, you could.
I know, but well, technically you could die doing anything.
Well, sure. That's why I felt safe in what I just said.
Well, we need some help, obviously. So joining us today is Ian Miller, rock climber. Welcome, Ian. Thanks for being here.
No bother.
Belay, Ian.
I think what you've got to remember is what you actually said about rock climbing should never, ever leave your thoughts. It is an activity in which if you do it wrong, you're going to get killed or injured. Oh. And that should never leave your thoughts.
Oh, you should think about this then.
Oh, absolutely. If you're not thinking along those lines, you're complacent. So when you're rock climbing, you're trying to avoid anything going wrong. And if you're not looking for it, it'll hit you when you least expect it, and that's not when you want to find yourself flying through the air.
No, that is what we want to avoid. So if we are a beginner and we're thinking about getting into this, I feel like I start with the gear. Like, what do I need to have before I can even start this so that I will be safe?
Okay. If you've never rock climbed before and you've never even been at a gym or anything at all, the first thing you need is knowledge. So if you know someone who goes rock climbing, ask them to take you out. If you don't know someone who goes rock climbing, the best thing nowadays to do is to go into any busy gym and pay for an introduction. And then you'll be able to go climbing and experience the activity while being looked after by somebody who knows what they're doing. And that's the first step that I would recommend everybody do, is just to see if they can do it safely. And that means going with somebody that knows what they're doing.
I would imagine that part of that kind of first trip out is just asking all sorts of questions, what different things that they're doing, and just being willing, almost like a sponge, to just be like, what is this experience that we're doing? Do you often teach first timers?
Oh, most of my like work life, if you like, is spent with people who have never climbed before, or with people who are trying to expand their horizons. So people want to go to do bigger things outdoors or harder things. When you first go for your first ever session at an indoor gym, you don't really ask many questions. You're going to just be told to do this, you do that. You don't really ask very much. and you trust what you're being shown, and then you have a shot at climbing. It's when you do your second session, you tend to think, okay, why? What's going on here? What's this knot for? What's the rope for? Most people in their first session will just simply allow you to tie them in, put their harness on correctly, check them out, and off they go and climb. They don't really ask many questions because the act of being off the ground is just usually enough for your first session.
It seems like that. Is there a certain progression from the gym to outside on actual rock, or does it matter?
Oh, about 20 years ago, I would have said not really.
Okay.
Because 20 years ago, indoor gyms were used by outdoor climbers. And I'm being quite general here.
Hmm.
Nowadays, the indoor gyms are used by people who have never climbed outdoors. And my brother's a great example. He goes to the gym every twice a week, and he treats it as a going to the gym session rather than a rock climbing session. And he'll never climb outdoors. No interest. So nowadays, the progression from the indoor climbing and outdoor climbing are not the same sport. They use the same and similar equipment, but the two things don't really join together quite as well as you would expect, because when you climb outdoors, no one's looking after you. There's no rules. You have to decide where you're going to climb, when you're going to climb, what the rock type, what equipment you need. When you climb indoors, a lot of that is taken care for you. If you were to break something or hold off indoors and be injured, then that's really bad for the gym.
Yeah.
So everything...
Good point.
Everything indoors is sanitized for your enjoyment, whereas everything outdoors... it's pretty much designed by nature to hurt you.
Designed by nature to hurt you.
We're visiting with Ian Miller about rock climbing. We've talked about sort of the indoor climbing style and the outdoor climbing style, and the fact that you've distinguished it to be two similar but very different sort of activities. I love hearing about the idea of the rock climbing gym, that is the indoor style, being an actual workout. If people are considering this and they're like, well, I'm not in the greatest of shape, do they need to sort of hit the gym, a regular gym, before they start climbing, or is the best way to gain these muscles just by going and hurting yourself in the indoor gym?
As someone who has never ever done very much exercise, or perhaps isn't regularly exercising, there are better ways to get in shape than going to a climbing gym. But if you're in reasonable shape, and I don't mean massively fit or all that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. I just mean you can walk to the shops, you can do the general things, then the workout you get from climbing is fantastic. But it's not the same, if you like, as being on an exercise bike for half an hour or running for half an hour. It's very, very different. It's more of a what we call an anaerobic exercise, in which there's not very much running about. You very, very quickly get what's called pumped. And that means the lactic acid rushes into your muscles and makes your muscles sore. And that can happen after you expending very little energy. So it's not a great cardio workout. Or it's not always a great cardio workout, but it is a great workout. But there are easier and better ways to get the same calories burnt, if you like. That kind of makes sense.
Yeah. No, that makes sense. And we want to. You need to be prepared, I think, whenever you're starting a new, hobby, especially if it's one as physical and dangerous as this one. So if we've got the gear ready and we've got the sort of, we know what kind of impact it will have on our body. What about that lingo? We started off talking about, we want to feel confident walking in. We know what some of the rock climbing lingo is that we should be aware of.
All of the lingo in rock climbing,
it's like
any, like a radio station, for example. You guys will speak to each other in a way you wouldn't speak to your partners at home, unless your partner at home is a person that works in the same industry. Mm-hmm. So in rock climbing, it's the same. It's like on belay, all that, for example, all that means is, have you got me?
Mm-hmm. Oh.
And you're asking your partner, do you have me? Which means, do they have the rope through the device in the right way? But as you're saying on belay, if you can see your partner, you're actually looking at their eyes, looking at the device, and the lingo you pick up very, very quickly. Basically, most things mean, am I safe? Yes, you are.
Oh, I like that. That's a reassuring, though, that that's what the lingo means. I didn't know that.
Yeah, well, if you think about the general sequence of events, indoors or outdoors, climb when ready, climbing on belay, off belay, all I'm doing and all my partner's doing is confirming that we are each, I have you safe, do you have me safe? I have you safe, do you have me safe? And the words mean different things. So I'm climbing means I'm moving, prepared to let out rope. Take, I'm about to fall. I think I'm going to fall. So, brace yourself.
Yeah.
Another thing about the lingo is that it says the words are used so that climb when ready is three short, sharp sounds. So if you're outdoors and it's a bit windy or you're out of sight of the person or you're quite a distance away from them on a pitch, the three short, short, sharp sounds are not mm-hmm. confused. So getting to know the lingo is, am I safe? Just bear that in mind. That's all you're really asking or asking to be confirmed. So the other half of the lingo is what climbers would use to describe what they're doing. So if you're hauling on a jug, means there's a great big hole that you can get your hands right round, or you're crimping on a dink, means you've got a tiny little piece that just your fingertips are on. So you're describing to someone with the same knowledge what they're expecting on the climb. And that just takes time. That's not really that important because you uh-huh. soon pick that up. And until you've gone climbing, you won't appreciate what a crimp is, what a jug is, what an underthing.
Well,
the most important thing it says that it's the safety. Mm-hmm. It's the
yeah,
safety.
We got to be safe out there.
I love a sport where the constant dialogue is, do you still have me?
No,
am I still safe? Are we still...
Brace yourself.
But get ready because I might die. You got me?
I know.
One of the things that impresses me about the rock climbing community, whether it be indoor or outdoor, is the fact that it is community. Mm-hmm. Like it is we don't care where you come from. We don't care who you are, but you're just sort of immediately accepted and then subsequently trusted because you're putting your life and taking the life of someone else into your own hands. Is that why it's so tight-knit?
If I was to meet you for the first time at a rock climbing venue, perhaps not indoors but outdoors, and you were to tell me that you were a great climber and you'd done all this stuff and you'd been doing it for decades, I could tell immediately if you had or hadn't, just by what you had on your rack, how you were standing, what you were doing with your equipment, what route you were about to do. There's a whole sub-dialogue in what we are as climbers.
Oh, huh.
So it's very, very quickly do you know who this person is as a climber. And pretty much everything else about them doesn't really matter because if you're going to fall off, you want to know you're going to land in air and not on the ground or on the rock face. So, again, me being safe with my climbing partner, you have shared moments. And mm-hmm. Adventure activities, adventure sports, and by their definition, these are sports that potentially things can go really badly wrong. So in these sports, you very quickly have experiences with people that you would never have if you're not doing the sport. So it's like a shared addiction or a shared love of an activity.
Yeah,
so
you know, at a time where people are looking for reasons and ways to sort of get out there and connect with people, it seems like a lot of people would be drawn to something like this. It's obvious that you feel so passionate about it. And I'm wondering what it is that keeps you coming back again and again to rock climbing and what you love about it most. Is it that community? Is it the mental or the physical component? What is it that has the most value for you?
Okay, the most value, and we're talking about outdoor climbing. Indoor climbing is a different values, different goals. But outdoors, especially when you get to a certain age, you tend to see things through 30, 40, 50-year-old eyes. And for me, the greatest experiences you can have outdoors are just moments. If you've been climbing for 40 years, my opinion is you've not yet had your best climb. You've not yet had your best experience. It might be the next one. And as you gather more and more fantastic never again experiences, you're always looking for the best one.
Yeah.
And that's what the draw is.
Wow.
You can't ever say that was the best. That was currently the best rock climb in my life, but tomorrow's might be better. Hmm. And it's the outdoors. It's the activity at times is the reason for you to visit places rather than visiting places to go climbing. That's when you've been doing it for, say, 10, 15 years. After that, you still enjoy climbing with great enthusiasm and passion, but you tend to visit places and enjoy where you are equally rather than just the climbing, mm-hmm. if that makes sense.
Yeah.
I think it's a pretty valuable lesson that we could even take out of rock climbing, right? Mm-hmm. That those moments that we're able to cherish in whatever we're doing, this may be a great moment, so cherish it, and then tomorrow may be an even greater moment. We've been visiting with Ian Miller, who is a full-time rock climber, guidebook author, and hill walker living, working, and playing on the sea cliffs, sea stacks, mountain ranges, and uninhabited islands of the County Donegal in the Republic of Ireland. Ian, thank you so much for being with us.
No bother.
I would be curious, if I ever make my way to Ireland, Ian, would you be willing to take me
wow.
on a beginner's climb?
I'll tell you what, you get yourself to Ireland, you come to Donegal, and I'll show you a place that you'll never believe exists.
All right.
You'll never have any comprehension of these two places that I'm thinking of. Just no experience required. Just come and play.
Okay.
Wow.
All right. You can find more about Ian online at uniqueascent.ie.
I always appreciate hearing people's passions, and it gets you thinking about getting out of your comfort zone.
And you also appreciated his accent, Lisa.
It wasn't bad. It wasn't bad.
It's great to have friends of the show return on and be able to tell us about their passions. So fun to have Ian back.
Now, why are more kids getting waitlisted by colleges than ever before? And what should you do if your child is one of them? That's coming up next.
You're listening to The Lisa Show.
You're listening to The Lisa Show.
Woo-hoo-hoo-hoo!
Yeah!
You make my life better.
Everything I need in the morning.
It's my favorite show ever.
They keep it fun in the morning.
I love you guys! I love you guys!
Welcome back to The Lisa Show. I'm Lisa Valentine Clark.
And I am Richie T.
Are you sick of going on runs and walks in the same streets and neighborhoods? Well, coming up in 20 minutes, we're going to explain why you should try trail running and what you need to know before you go.
And when you visit your local shopping, you know, now that you're going to be able to get out of the house and be able to go to a mall or
yeah.
or a strip mall, beware, Build-A-Bear has got your kid's number.
Uh-oh.
A brand new thing from Build-A-Bear that you should be aware of. Pretty excited about it. It's coming up in your morning buzz.
It's that time of the year that as the days get warmer and school starts winding down, high school seniors, they're looking forward to graduation and anticipating those college acceptance letters. They're rolling in. You know, you see people posting on social media where they're going, where they want to go. But the college application process is super stressful. And after 4 years of hard work, you know, we all want to see that someone else is recognizing how great our kids are. We also want our kids to be able to dream and keep moving forward. But of course, This year, as with everything else, things are a little bit different, and getting into college might be a little trickier or at least weirder than ever before. So here to share his wisdom with us about what we can expect and what's a little bit different is the editor-in-chief of the Princeton Review, Rob Franek. Welcome back, Rob.
Hey, Lisa, Richie, good to hear both of your voices, and thanks for the invitation.
Yeah, you bet. College admissions look a little bit different this year. Explain to us a little bit of the situation.
Well, a couple of things. And any way that we unspool COVID-19's impact on any of our businesses, but then, as you said in your opening, just on students in general, mm-hmm. high school juniors, high school seniors, and then freshmen in college have experienced over the last 13 months of time tectonic shift, not only in their academic experience at high school, but then in the college admission process going into last year, fall of 2020, certainly, and then certainly going into 21 as well. But students and parents are nervous about lots of things. Money, at level mm-hmm. of debt being the number one and two, but then also thinking about what's going to happen to them next year, concerned about going to school continuously remotely.
Yeah, a lot of things up in the air. I have a high school senior. We're trying to make a lot of decisions about next year. And I found that it's a lot of qualifying statements like, well, if things are opened up, then I want to do this. If things are still remote like this, then I want to do that.
Right.
Does this make people skittish? Are more or less people applying to college?
Well, it's a good question, and I didn't realize you were right in the channel with your high school senior. So this is a perfect and timely. Just to set the deadlines out there, you were very right that students are receiving their letters acceptance now or denial. But then, right around that May 1st deadline, which is the national decision deadline, some schools might extend it this year. But you're right; many schools are qualifying to say, "Hey, as long as COVID-19 continues to crest, then we will be open in person this fall." And that is going to be the deciding factor for so many students and, of course, schools as well. But students and their parents are voting with their feet. They are looking, and this is based on our survey information from this College Hopes and Worries survey that we have at the Princeton Review, and the data just came out less than 4 weeks ago. And it was around sticker cost and that driving the schools that students would actually apply to, or probably consider going to, and then also being a bit closer to home. Again, a real repercussion of the pandemic.
Oh, yeah.
So what is this college wait list? We sort of call it that, and I'm not sure that everyone understands what the term means.
Sure. Waitlist simply means that a student is not denied nor are they accepted. And generally speaking, it is a strategic move, an enrollment strategic move for a school itself. And this year, more than ever, because it is the Wild West, we don't know what exactly is going to happen for students. We don't know if there's going to be the cratering that we saw at so many schools for fall of 2020, simply meaning that there were less students that actually decided to matriculate, to enroll at schools last fall. So a lot of schools might be hedging their bets with the class this year and putting them onto a wait list. Generally speaking, after that May 1st national decision deadline, most schools will then move to their wait list and say, okay, I've got to take the top 10% of those wait list students and accept them to my school, and then they can matriculate into the fall of 2021 freshman class.
It's such a difficult space for someone to be in if they are waitlisted, because as you say, it doesn't mean that they were denied, but it also doesn't mean that they were accepted. I wish that colleges would sort of lean into it in a humorous way and just send you a letter that says, we have received your request, buffering, and then that's it. And you just we'll get back to you as far as all this goes.
They're not really in a jokey mood, though, when they get a college acceptance
Sure.
Oh, true. It's crushing. It's crushing for so many students, to be accepted or denied. Or you're right, the buffering. I'm totally going to use that, Richie, and I'm give you attribution, but that's an awesome one.
Thank you very much.
We appreciate being able to talk to you, Rob, from the Princeton Review about college wait lists and admissions and how it looks a little bit different this year. I'd like to have you give us a little bit of your advice now. If somebody does find themselves on a wait list, what should they be considering? What should they be aware of?
First thing on my list is hold off until all decisions come in, whether that's a waitlist decision or certainly an acceptance at some schools. So generally speaking, this week, most students across the globe will find out, and they've really found out over the last couple of weeks, but Ivy League colleges this week will be sending out their letters of admission. So once this week crests, then students will know where they're admitted. And then, of course, you have to compare packages. And what I mean is all of the research that students and parents have done over the last year of time to find out if that college or university is actually going to be a best fit for them. And then we have to talk about finances. We know that even pre-COVID, finances and level of debt were a huge concern. Factor in a global pandemic, and that just becomes all the more dear, right?
Right.
So students need to be patient. They need to wait. They have, generally speaking, until that May 1st deadline. It might be a little extended this year, as it was last year, to decide between them, their parents, and their counselors what's the best decision for them.
I've heard conversation with a lot of folks that the COVID-19 pandemic has just sort of ushered in the disruption that was coming towards post high school education anyway. What do you think, or what are you seeing as far as whether kids are even going to go to college or whether these online bachelor's degree programs will gain in popularity?
I totally hear you, and I so agree. This is a shift in the way that education is going to happen, right? And that sounds so hyper, but the truth is that we're not going to unlearn many of the things that we've all learned, not only academically, but otherwise over the last now 13, 14 months of time, right?
Yeah.
So we understand, and there's a glorious value to that as well. You know, having hybrid classes is going to be able to provide access to many more students, access to classes that students might not have had at a particular college or university. That's a value. But the truth is, colleges are listening to students. There is fatigue. We all understand it, Zoom and otherwise, through the pandemic. So we understand students want to get back onto campus. They want to be there in person. Hybrid classes will still likely be there, but they are still saying college is worth it. Their parents are saying college is worth it. That's what our survey has revealed, certainly this year and in past mm-hmm. years. And I think there's some solace in that as well.
Yeah. Do you feel like it's getting harder to get into colleges? Is it harder this year?
Well, it is harder depending on the school, and there, without question, this is quantifiable from, again, this College Hope Summary Survey mm-hmm. we're doing it 18 years, 20% greater stress level than in 2003 when we first started. So that's a given. Stress is at a fever pitch, even before the pandemic, but heightened because of it. But the truth is that there are more schools, or there are a handful of schools that have received so many more applications. I know you all reported on this. We reported on the Princeton Review, the Ivy League, some of them up 30, 40% more applications this year
wow.
than in years past. So that means that the freshman class is not going to grow incredibly for fall of 2021, which we're going to see many disappointed students this year more than last because there's just a bigger applicant pool this year. But the truth is there are more than 3,500 four-year colleges in the U.S. alone, mm-hmm. many of them are not in that same boat as the most competitive schools in the country, right? They still have room in your freshman class. So if your listeners take one thing away, there is a best fit school out there for each student. I'm going to say it's several best fit schools out of those 3,500, and there is value in this process.
That's very encouraging.
For a while, there was a stigma that if you went to one university and then transferred to another, that first of all, it would be more difficult, and that secondarily, some schools would look at it and be like, why wouldn't you just commit to one place for your 4 years? Is that going away?
It is going away, and for a couple of reasons, just in the most current thing, right? So students, due to COVID, are likely going to stay closer to home. They might go to a home state university or city college or even a community college, a two-year associate's degree granting institution, and then move on to a four-year. There's no stigmata, associated with that, and many students might choose that for safety reasons. They might choose it for financial reasons, but then ultimately that four-year degree, that bachelor's degree, will be at a four-year college. But students will be treated the same 2 years from now through that transfer process.
What about college tests like the ACT or SAT? We're seeing a lot of changes in how colleges are using them. Do you think that they're here to stay?
I do, without question, think that the SAT and the ACT are here to stay. They are going to change, however, to the tests that were different from the SAT and ACT before the pandemic. Right now, they are remaining, the structure, content, and delivery are exactly the same. But ACT specifically has been alluding to the fact that they could be that first major test that would be offered remote, online, at home, or in school. Mm-hmm. And that's a huge shift because so many students throughout 2020, the first time a kid to take the SAT in 2020 was August 29th. So continuously canceled. So students have to want and the need, right, to take an SAT and ACT because it's of value, but they just simply weren't able to do it from a durability standpoint. Testing was not available to them. But that's going to continue to change as the year progresses.
People that are listening that want to help their kids to be competitive, to get into the school that they want, what, on kind of a broader picture, are things that help increase the likelihood for admission to university?
The number one thing, and I tell this to all of my students at the Princeton Review, is your high school transcript. Every admission counselor at schools, large and small, public or private, it matters not, are going to ask first about how well you did in high school, and then ask, did you challenge yourself with regular level courses, advanced level courses, AP level courses, IB level courses? What were the opportunities that did you have? Did you take advantage of them? And then obviously, what's your GPA? But second, and still most important, even through the test optional movement, meaning students didn't submit their SAT and ACTs, but they're not precluded from submitting them, are our standardized tests, SAT, ACT, and of course AP exams coming up in May.
Does your advice change when we're talking about grad school? Are we seeing similar trends there?
We are seeing huge numbers of students considering moving on to graduate school, law school, B school, med school, and then, of course, just grad art and sciences. We see this in our own business at the Princeton Review because we prep for all of those tests, LSAT, GR, GMAT, and so on. And that's not uncommon. When we've seen downturns in the economy, many students then that have a bachelor's degree already will consider moving on to grad or professional school. We're seeing the same thing, but, you know, at a much higher scale due to COVID.
Wow. Okay. So finally, I mean, you've just given us so much good information as we look across this like complicated, what can seem overwhelming process. Since everything is so competitive this year, for that advice that you want to give for those parents and kids who are listening, who are going through the process right now, what are your final words of encouragement to them?
Just two quick things. For students that have received a letter of admission over the last couple of weeks or this week if they're for applying to the Ivies, make sure, again, that you wait for all your letters to come in and go to virtual events or real events on campus if you can get there. That is going to be the last part of that deciding which is the best fit school for me. For those students and parents that are just a little younger, maybe sophomores or juniors in high school, folks, there is a school out there for you. Use your expertise and prowess that you've developed over the last year of time and really start to interface and build relationships with schools virtually and then augment them, you know, in person as COVID crests over the next couple of months.
Rob Franek, great to have you back on the show. Thanks for being with us.
A pleasure, folks. Take care.
Rob Franek is the editor-in-chief of the Princeton Review and a nationally recognized expert on colleges and higher education. You can find out more about the Princeton Review at princetonreview.com. And you know who is a good follow on Twitter? Rob Franek.
Yeah.
You can find him at Rob Franek on Twitter.
Are you ready to get outside and get off that treadmill, that stationary bike, and get out? Well, don't worry. We're going to get you ready to consider trail running.
And a warning for parents who might be returning to shopping malls in their area. That's coming up in your Morning Buzz. You're listening to The Lisa Show.
Welcome back to The Lisa Show. Now, we're all hoping that the arrival of the COVID-19 vaccine means that some of the jobs that were lost are coming back. In 20 minutes, we're going to find out what we can expect from the economy in the next couple of months. But first, it's time for your Morning Buzz with Richie T.
It's three things that are trending online right now. This first one, just sad. British actor Paul Ritter, who you would likely recognize if you see him. He was in one of the Harry Potter movies. He died of a brain tumor at the age of 54. Oh. And the internet is speaking about what their favorite Paul Ritter, either film or project, was. People might also recognize him from the HBO Sky drama Chernobyl as well. People paying their respect to Paul. Online. Also, today is Empowered Women Entrepreneurs Day.
Nice.
So how do you celebrate Empowered Women Entrepreneurs Day? Seek out that woman-owned business today and give them some of your money. Now, you can purchase something or use their service, but they'll also, I would imagine, though I haven't contacted all the empowered entrepreneurs that are women, whether they would just take your money. They might just take your money if you just said, here, I'd like you to have my money. They may just do that, but
also like, for goods and services.
Yeah, but also goods and services as well. So consider that as you're shopping about today to turn your attention towards empowered women entrepreneurs in your area. And then finally this is just a warning for parents.
Oh, okay.
You know Build-A-Bear, where you get to create the personality and the costume. Do I? Yeah. Did you do a Build-A-Bear with a kid?
With the kids,
all,
plural?
Yeah.
Yeah, so, it's a fun mix of, like, are you sure you want that one?
Yeah. And the little thing that you can put on the inside, so that there's a little...
There's a lot of upsells in that place.
Well, good for Build-A-Bear, and especially, they have now partnered with Animal Crossing, you know, that ever-popular game. So now you can get stuffed Animal Crossing games. So
kids are going to go
so
nuts.
So here is the warning. Keep your kids very far away from the Build-A-Bear unless you're prepared for them to fall in love and need.
That is good marketing.
That new new Build-A-Bear. It's an Animal Crossing. Parents, be warned.
Oh, no.
That is your morning buzz.
Thanks, Richie T. It's no secret that running regularly has a lot of health benefits. Study after study shows that running consistently can lead to stronger joints, improved cardiovascular health, and even reduce stress and improve mental health. And yet many of us still lack the motivation to sort of lace up our sneakers and get running in the morning. So what is it that we could do to be more motivated to run? Could it be that we need a change of scenery?
Could be.
Well, here invited into our conversation about running is Ricky Gates, a professional runner who's run on all 7 continents and nearly 40 different countries to teach us about tips and tricks to trail running. Welcome, Ricky.
Hi, thanks for having me on the show, guys.
Thanks for being here.
You know, Ricky, I have to, when I hear that you've run on all 7 continents and 40 different countries, I think that's a guy who would hate running on the treadmill.
Oh, yeah.
Is that true? Is that in fact the case?
You would be very accurate with that one. If I have to, I'll run on the treadmill, but I don't have one in my garage, and I tend to avoid them. There's very few conditions out there where I think the treadmill is the better option. But, you know, some people, if that's what it takes to get them motivated, then I've got nothing against it.
Yeah, but it's also an encouraging thought because some people think, why would I want to start running outside? I hate the treadmill. And it might just be, oh, yeah, lots of people do, even a professional runner. So I actually think it's pretty encouraging. When we talk about trail running, though, that's a little bit different than just on the pavement, so to speak. If someone is trying trail running for the first time and it's something that they're not experienced with, what do they have to prepare and how is it a little bit different than just running in your neighborhood?
Well, I kind of find that it's not all that different, really. If you're just getting started, I think what's most important is to not set your expectations too high. You know, I think a lot of people out there, they get motivated by these ultra marathons or they see some videos on YouTube and they want to go out there and run 20 or 30 or 50 miles through the mountains. And I think that's how people end up getting injured. And also even worse is how people get discouraged. So kind of my recommendation is to just start off easy. Go find a local trail. And don't be too hard on yourself. Get out there, and if it means starting off hiking and then switching into a jog a little bit, then switching back to hiking, I think that's a wonderful recipe for getting into the sport.
So, how can you get the most out of your trail running experience?
I think just being present. You know, we have our phones with us pretty much all the time these days, and it can be a really helpful tool for trail running in terms of finding trails and tracking your run. But to mostly just be out there and keep your phone in your pocket, try and keep it away and just be present. So for me, that means paying attention to one or two strides ahead of me and then going from there and just kind of paying attention to what's around me. I mean, The beauty of trail running is that you're out there in nature or some form of nature, and that can mean listening to the birds, seeing new plants and flowers, and really experiencing the conditions. So really, for me, it's about being present.
When I think about trail running, the thing that comes immediately to mind as the most important thing is footwear, wearing the proper shoes.
I learned that the hard way.
Are we accurate that that would be the most important consideration?
It's certainly one of the most important considerations. If someone has just one pair of shoes, and that's what's holding them back from going out for a trail run, then I would say that that's not the most important. Motivation is the most important. But in terms of gear, a good pair of shoes is really wonderful to have. I have a technique for finding the right pair of shoes for me. I go and I take full advantage of the local running store or the REI, whatever is closest to you. And I try on one shoe on one foot and then a different shoe on a different foot. And whichever feels better between those two, I stick with that one. And then I move to a different pair and try that on the other foot. I find that is extremely helpful for narrowing down which shoe is going to feel the best. I don't think that like extreme traction on the bottom of your feet is essential to trail running. But it can certainly be pretty helpful, and depending on where you live, if you've got more mud or dirt or whatever it might be.
Talking with Ricky Gates, who is a professional runner, about trail running, when you were talking about how you pick the perfect shoes and you put one of one kind on a foot and one of another kind on another foot, I was hoping that that story ended with you. And I run out of the store, and whichever one that I take off to throw at the people coming after me, that's the one. That you would,
no.
In addition to the shoes that we, when we talk about gear for trail running, how important are things like socks, or people would say like a Camelback, and to be able to stay hydrated? What else do we need to know?
What other equipment?
Yeah, so this is kind of as you progress further into the sport, as you increase your mileage, there's no doubt about it, and I will spare you the details, but socks are very, very important. I learned that the hard way. When I ran across the country a couple of years ago, proper sock maintenance and lack thereof can certainly do a number on your feet if you're not careful about it. And then, as you mentioned there, the kind of the brand name that started it all was Camelback back in the day. It has become such a huge part of trail running that nearly every company out there has a really wonderful form of hydration vest wear. I run for Salomon Running, and they've got a great line of running vests out there. But these are all essentially very, very small and tight-fitting backpacks that are geared for holding water and food and perhaps your phone close to your body, up around your torso. That can allow you to take anywhere from a half liter to a liter and a half of water, food for a few hours or an entire day out there, and possibly some other running accessories that might help you stay longer out there, because that's ultimately the goal with trail running, is figuring out how to stay out on the trails for as long as possible.
Well, and you mentioned earlier, you have a lot of experience and expertise on this. I'm curious as to what made you decide to run across America, and what really, you know, got you into trail running?
Well, those are two different things. I got into trail running because I grew up in the Rockies. And when I grew up there and on the running team, we just called it running. There was no real distinction between trail running and road running. It just made sense to hit the trails because that's what was out the back door. And I grew to love it in my 20s and late 20s. I started competing in it both here in the States and then abroad. I spent a lot of time in Europe racing on the trails and in the mountains there. It was by the time I got to my early 30s when I had been running for quite a while, racing all over the world, loving it, but also kind of wanting something more out of the sport than just athleticism. And that's when I decided that I would run across the country. This is 2017. I was a little bit confused at where the country was going, and I wanted to get to know my fellow compatriots on a face-to-face and step-by-step basis. And so I set off from Folly Beach in South Carolina on March 1st of 2017, and 5 months later, I arrived at Ocean Beach in San Francisco, having covered about 3,700 miles and
wow.
and meeting a lot of strangers that very quickly became friends, and I gained a much better understanding of this country that I've been born into and that I've loved for my entire life. And it was an incredible experience.
My hope for that is wow. at the end, two things. One, that you grew a beard and grew your hair out long.
You just love the movie, Forrest Gump.
And that when you were done, you just looked at everyone else who was running with you and said, well, I guess I'll go home now. I would be curious, as you sought to learn about the country and the people that live here, you know, what sort of things did you take away from that?
Well, to answer your question, I did grow a beard.
Yes!
My hair did grow out pretty long. I lost about, and I don't, mind you, have a lot of weight to lose. I lost 25 to 30 pounds.
Oh, wow.
I was a human skeleton by the end of it. But at the end, you know, kind of the conclusion that I came to is, you know, we're oftentimes painted a picture in this country of pretty severe division.
Mm-hmm.
And I found, you know, that we're much more similar than we are different. You know, if I were to put a number on it, I'd say we're 90% the same and only 10% different. You know, in an age of social media and other types of media, in politics, that 10% can really be latched onto and made to appear as though it's much bigger.
Hmm.
So the run across the country just really illuminated to me that, you know, we have so much more in common than we do apart.
It's such a connecting idea. And it's interesting that as we talk about running and running trails, that we're always talking about participating or really connecting with other people. Do you find that you run in groups better, or do you sometimes enjoy a solitary run?
To be truthful, most of my runs are on my own. I do really appreciate the solitude and kind of the meditative practice mm-hmm. of being out there and listening to my breath and just paying attention to my surroundings. I do not to put a plug on my own running trips. I do put together running trips here in the States and beyond Mexico and Japan. And that's an opportunity for me to put together a group of runners and spend a week running together. So those moments I absolutely cherish. I get the opportunity to meet complete strangers and get to know them quite intimately over 5 or 6 or 7 days. And I think they get quite a lot out of it as well. Just kind of a gathering of like-minded people and having a shared experience and, you know, suffering a little bit together, but also taking in the beauty and the sights and sounds all around you. It's really quite magical.
Oh, wow.
People are starting to find themselves outside of their home, spring coming on, you know, across the country, weather's getting better. People may have put on a pound or two during the time of the pandemic, and they're looking to do something maybe that they haven't done for a long time or something that they have never done before. They look to trail running, and I want to give you a minute worth of time to inspire those people to head to the trails and to give what you have now made a profession out of, give that a shot.
Yeah, so the thing that I'm most cautious when trying to get people into this sport is to, again, just be easy on yourselves. I think that people can be so hard on themselves. Such a huge part of my job with running and trying to convince people to get into running or to even join my running trips is to just not be so hard on yourself. Like I said earlier, it's so important to get out there and if you feel like starting off with a hike, then start off hiking and then move into a jog and then move back to a hike. Whatever it is that gets you moving and gets your blood flowing and gets you out on the trails. That's kind of my number one motto is
mm-hmm.
to just be easy on yourself. All of these things takes time and patience, and it's an endurance sport for a reason. It's not just endurance over a single run. It's endurance over weeks and months and years. So I just highly encourage people to stick with it and not be hard on themselves.
Well, finally, what's next for you?
So I've got a couple things. After I ran across the country, it had kind of occurred to me that my journey through America was primarily rural. So I was living in San Francisco at the time and decided to take on a project that I called Every Single Street, which was to run every street in San Francisco to kind of get a better sense of a more urban America. So that was a couple years ago, about 1,300 miles over the course of 5 or 6 weeks. And I've taken that project to my new hometown where I'm living now in Santa Fe, New Mexico. And getting to know this new city on the same basis, which is a lot of fun and another great way to get into shape and get to know this town that I'm living in. I've also been watching it grow around the country and around the world. A lot of people, especially during the lockdown, have taken on this project to get to know their own cities and counties and towns where they've lived and perhaps haven't known quite as well as they thought they did. That's part of what I've got going on is doing that project myself here in Santa Fe, but also encouraging other people to take on that project wherever they might live. And then the other project that I'm working on is called the 50 Classic Trails of North America, which is probably more pertinent to our conversation right now. But there was a book in the 1970s called The 50 Classic Climbs of North America, which was really inspiring to me as a climber and sort of mountaineer in my earlier days. And I wanted to kind of take the same concept and similar parameters and kind of explore the United States and try and find 50 trails that I kind of consider might paint a complete picture or as close to a complete picture as possible of this incredible beauty and nature that we have in North America and Canada and Mexico and here in the States. So those are the two kind of projects that I've been working on and will continue to work on over the next couple of years.
You can continue to see updates at rickygates.com. That's R-I-C-K-E-Y gates.com. Ricky Gates, a professional runner, has joined us on the show. He ran across the country, has run on all 7 continents, and visited nearly 40 countries. Thanks for being with us, Ricky.
Are you going to go on a run today?
Right now?
Yeah.
Yes, I'm going to go right now.
Later this afternoon aren't you?
Well, no, I was going to go right now.
No, you got to wait because we're going to tell you what you should expect from the job market in the next couple of months.
All right. I was going to run right now, but I'm going to stick around for that. You're listening to The Lisa Show. Welcome back to The Lisa Show. We want to peel back the curtain a little bit and let you know some discussion that's being had off the air here at The Lisa Show. Where our studios are broadcast from, it's very exciting. We are getting restructured. Sounds like people are being let go. That's not what's occurring.
Well, like new carpet.
Yeah.
I don't know.
That was my favorite.
Some cubicles.
It was announced to us that the cubicle walls are going away, and I feel
like there's a metaphor there.
And they are revamping down to the carpet.
Yeah.
And one of the things that this means is that all of us in cube country, as we like to call it, that would be myself and other producers of the show. That land, that territory of which we inhabit at this point will be unavailable for a while.
Yeah, it's under construction. You can't work there.
All of the folks that have offices, like Lisa Valentine Clark,
I have an office,
will be unaffected by having an office. And so the discussion then became, who is going to share offices with one another? And Lisa, because of the person that you are, you said, you know what, why don't you come into my office and we can sort of co-work together.
I've got an open door policy. I've got snacks.
Yeah, I'm hoping that we can have this discussion because I'm not sure that's the best decision for the show for me to be in the same office with you because we have the time on the air.
It's too much time with me. Is that what you're saying?
Well,
a little bit.
I'm
a loud talker.
I'm afraid for a couple things.
Yeah.
how can you miss me if I never go away? is the first thing, right? Like, you know, the idea of an absence makes the heart grow fonder. That's part of it. Two, I'm tremendously worried because you have almost a charcuterie of snacks within your office.
I like to be prepared.
I'm not sure that the old waistline as I get older and, okay. and things slow okay. down.
Good point.
I'm not sure that that would be. And
wait, I should interrupt and say, too, it's not like I can just offer something or you know it's not even offered. It's yeah. like behind a locked, closed drawer.
Right.
You just sense that it's there yep. and you can't help yourself.
Exactly. Exactly. And so I'm not sure if it's a great choice to do that. I appreciate the yeah. offer that you've made. I'm excited about the new carpet that will be coming.
Well, the weather's nicer now. And so maybe you can just use one of the picnic tables outside
yeah,
to do your
work. Maybe I can
work.
Get them to set up a computer
yeah.
outside.
yeah, maybe.
That may not be the case. But I thought it was very gracious of you to say, you know what, why don't you come in here? There are other people who I assume they still work here, but we haven't seen them actually working in office.
For about a year.
Yeah,
weird.
For about a year. Year, I think I may just take over one of them. And then that leads me to the second part of
okay.
this, which is with this sort of construction, we have in our offices what I have wanted to have be my office for the longest time.
Okay.
They have a little phone room, and I've never seen one of these anywhere I've ever worked. I would be curious how common that they are.
For those of you who are unfamiliar, like, have you ever been to – I see these all the time in hotels. You know, they'll have little – phone. It's not a phone booth, but it's just a little closet with a bench and a phone.
Yeah, you see them. The only place that I can recollect seeing them is at the airport, right? It's
yeah.
almost like it's like a teeny cubicle. But it's behind.
Or you see them in nice like conference centers.
Yes, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It's if you need to make a phone call, essentially, this is a small designated room
mm-hmm.
where ideally people can't kind of hear what's going on. You can just sort of tuck yourself away. It's probably 12 square feet of room, right? It's probably a little 3x4
the
room.
The idea of you fitting in, like there's not even room for a table.
No.
Just like mounting a computer to the
yes.
wall or something
yes.
and putting the keyboard on your lap as
yes.
you sit with your knees up to your neck. It feels real funny
to me. I have long
you should just
pitched
do it.
For the opportunity to just do it. And part of me, sort of peeling the curtain back a little bit more, part of me has just thought, well, if I just commandeer this room, by the time someone notices, I'll say, I've been here for 6 months.
Yeah, especially
it clearly
during COVID.
It clearly
yeah.
doesn't matter. Can't I just continue to be in this space?
Which is funny because the office that you have now, yes, it is surrounded by cubicle walls,
mm-hmm.
is quite large.
Yeah, spacious even.
So you want, basically, you're trading, in your mind, a space for a ceiling.
Well,
because that's what you don't have. You don't have a ceiling right
well,
now. That's it.
What I don't have and what I know you appreciate is the ability to shut a door and lock people out.
Every parent
yeah.
knows the value of having a room where you can shut the door and lock the lock
yes.
It.
Yeah. This is mommy's space. This is dad's, you know. We crave to have these individual spaces where it's just like, yeah, it's
mine.
Is
it psychological or is it a need?
I mean, with me, most things are psychological,
yeah, good point.
I feel like. But to further explore your invitation, let me ask you, if I accept your invitation for us to co-work in this short time period, can I bring my own art for the office? Can I decorate my small portion?
This is getting a little bit more complicated than
yeah.
I thought.
Yeah.
What I feel like I need to clarify that I invited both of the producers.
Sure.
So we have a producer, Bella.
Uh-huh.
I was making the offer to her,
uh-huh.
and you are within earshot.
And I happen to hear. So the invitation was not necessarily
not
for me.
I'm not saying that. I'm saying I know that we're going to need to shift some things around
mm-hmm.
and share offices.
Sure.
Bella, you're welcome.
Yeah, it will be a couple of months. So I guess expanding this conversation back out again, so I don't take you up on our offer and I take one of
the
offices.
Booth. I just for fun.
Yeah, I think they're actually destroying it. I get the impression that that's one of the things that will be reconstructed.
There's a utility closet, too.
I have already asked about a key to the janitor's closet.
And there's a
closet.
Sink in there,
yeah,
too.
I know.
And it's closer to the bathroom.
Yes.
So maybe that you should
Lots
consider
Lots of bonuses,
that.
But they said no to that as well. So my question then remains, maybe we don't co-share our space, but I will be maybe taking over for the portion that we're here in the morning time, another of the offices. Do you suppose that it's okay for me to decorate that space?
Just don't put nails in the wall, and I think you're good.
Yeah?
Yeah.
So like
a strips.
Command strips?
Yeah.
Okay.
Do that. You know, it's so funny talking to people about the creative spaces that they have used for offices, you know, over the last year.
Sure.
You know, I've changed certain parts in my bedroom. I have this like table, and I have moved it and set it up for times when we've done this show remotely. Mm-hmm. And now that I work part of the day at home, I have it all set up with, you know, my setup sheets and story ideas and computer in a different way. I wonder if people will keep their home offices the way that they have, or if, you know, as spaces are used for different, you know, functions, if they'll go back to what they were. I wonder, I guess, is what I'm saying, if I'll ever get my kitchen table back or if it will always be the homework station. Honestly, like now we eat at the kitchen counter instead of the kitchen table, because the kitchen table has all of my kids' Chromebooks and their textbooks and their notes. And at first I was like, okay, put that stuff away at the end of the day. But then it didn't make any sense because they were using it more often than we were using it to eat.
Mm-hmm.
And then we just cleaned it off for Sunday dinner.
Yeah. Once a week, it's cleared
Once
off.
Once a week, it's cleared off. But the rest of the time, the kitchen table has become the homework station.
So what have you, from this time, from the last year, what are the things that you like and that you hope will never go away?
Oh, I do love that question, because I'm trying to look for the positive right now.
Right.
Feeling that sort of... In all honesty, I'm really feeling that COVID fatigue.
Sure.
Of yes, vaccines are rolling out, and I'm looking forward to getting my shot, and I hope it goes well, and all of those feelings. But I do feel like overwhelmed with that. So the things that I have liked, though, have just been being with my kids more and being really just involved in what's going on with their schedules. They've had more time at home, and they've been forced to be home.
Mm-hmm.
But I just really like my kids. They're funny, they're interesting, and I like it. And I know that as things open up, they're going to want to be with their friends more and be out more and be at school more with extracurriculars and that kind of stuff. And I know that that's coming, but I really have liked that family time, which I guess is a really great realization to be like, I like being with my kids. And I like that time where I've also really relaxed on what I thought was important. Like, you've got to get this done and da 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 da. And I've really lightened up on that of saying, you know, mental health and not just being overly busy and stressed out was a good reality check for us. Yeah. Deep breath.
Yeah. It's interesting to take that perspective of looking back over the last year and being able to say, you know, not necessarily the white glove or the silver linings or that, but there will be that shift and change as people go back to work that they're like, oh, I really miss lunches at home, you know, being able to save some money because I could prep my, you know, I could take my break from lunch and be able to do that.
I do like my schedule a lot better now because, you know, we're here so early in the morning but I like it. It's quiet.
Mm-hmm.
And then I like being able to go home and kind of switch gears a little bit and work a little bit at home, because I find it gives me a different perspective that I'm like, you work at work. And then you're at home and you leave it. But it gives me a different perspective. And I feel like I can look at work with fresh eyes. So it's something that I didn't anticipate that I would really like, working part from home and part in office. And I thought, oh, no, I won't like that. And I was wrong. I've changed my mind. I like it.
So going back to where the conversation began which is spaces are changing here. I want to propose something back to you. You invited me that I could be able to – I mean, technically, you sort of invited me and then uninvited me to be able to share space with you.
I sent out a general invitation and
you picked it up off the floor. Yeah, I happen to be within earshot, I think, were your exact words.
No, of course.
But I would be curious, could I, as your kids go back to school – could I take over your kitchen table as my office? It would just be a shared workspace for I would remove my work papers for Sunday dinner.
Oh, great.
I would keep it clean, shoes off at the door. I'm just looking for a functionable workspace for a couple of hours each day.
Yeah, right.
Consider it. And I'd lock the front door so that way, similar to that whole door thing like you have on your office.
Sure, sure, sure.
I would lock you out for just the time that I'm working. I'm just looking for possible solutions.
You're being creative. I like this sort of brainstorming. Are there things that you have liked about the past year that you find that you're going to keep moving forward?
I have really liked something that I didn't do before, which was taking breaks. I was oftentimes a person who would just work and work and work, and then I would be done and then be done.
Mm-hmm.
But for whatever reason, working here and otherwise has just seemed sort of harder to do.
Uh-huh.
And so rather than just like...
Yeah, it's more time-intensive.
Yeah, yeah. So mm-hmm. I will just... I'll be like, I'm going to work until noon on mm-hmm. this thing. And then no matter what happens at noon, I'm going to make a sandwich and take my dog Robert on a walk.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll do that regardless. And before I would have been like, well, if I push through till 2 o'clock, then I'll be done completely.
Yeah.
And I just find that I don't have not the stamina, but maybe that's exactly what it is. The other thing that I have really come to appreciate is the value of sleep to be able to take on whatever comes on the next day. And I had recognized that, sure, before. But because so many things have been uncertain and I tend to be a bit of an anxious person, meaning if something gets me worried, I don't just go, oh, that has place of worry in my heart and now I'll let it go. It's ruminate, it's spin, it's all of those things. And I find that the ability to be able to function at a greater and higher level increases as I just sleep more. And so that's been practices like making sure that my sheets and my comforter is constantly clean. Not every day, obviously, but every couple of weeks I'm cleaning those things.
That's interesting. I didn't expect you to say that.
I learned from this show the idea of having a go-to-sleep alarm clock, which essentially triggers my brain to go, oh, now I have to go brush my teeth, and then I'm going to shower, and then I go to bed. Similar to the wake-up alarm clock, but it indicates, no, day is over, put it away, and go, go to sleep. As far as that goes, caffeine intake is another thing that I'm working at. That's maybe the hardest thing from the last year, because in those times where it's just like, oh, I need to be able to keep going. What can I do? Is there a soda that I can drink? Is there a this, that, whatever, to be able to get me? So,
it is interesting hearing your perspective, because as we look at the things that we sort of fell into, we didn't know how long we were planning for. So we all made decisions based on maybe 2 weeks ahead, maybe a month ahead.
Oh, we'll be done by June 2020.
Yeah, and we kept doing that. And I feel like about the end of the summer, we thought, oh, maybe never. We all kind of got another low, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then it's the same thing at the beginning of the year. A constant readjustment for an undetermined amount of time can cause a lot of mental and physical stress. And I hope that the things that we've learned about being resilient and pushing through and remaining positive when possible, because it's not realistic to say that you can be positive all the time about any of this, but finding out those tried and true truly tested things that work and sharing those with each other, I think has great value. It really, really helps me, because some things that I tried, especially in the beginning, didn't work.
Yeah.
And so I needed to try something new. So what remains has really been tried and true. You know, that when you talk about sleep and when I talk about habits and staying in the exercise, to get out that kind of anxiety and mental frustration has is something that I need to continue to do.
Yeah. A particular meme sort of struck me yesterday, and I'm not one that's usually inspired by memes.
Yeah.
I sort of look at them and go, that's cute, or sort of dismiss them out of hand. But the one that said, how many feel like you have survived the last year? Now it's our turn to thrive. Oh. And for some reason, I just was like, yeah, you know, I don't know that any of us look back at the last year and say, oh, man, I'm living my best life. These are the things. This is where I'm at. But yeah. That we all just sort of clung white knuckled and said, you know what? I want to keep it together as best I can,
but
whether that's financial or health.
We should congratulate ourselves.
Right.
We survived.
But as we come out on the other side of this and have the opportunity to be very intentional in the things that we do,
mm-hmm.
to now recognize what has brought us joy from the last year that we weren't getting before that.
Yeah.
Remember what we were getting as joy from before the pandemic, combine the two and be able to move forward and truly be able to thrive. Look at that.
It.
Inspired by an internet meme.
I know. I like it. And I appreciate you sharing that, because as we start to look towards things opening up and our schedules to change once again, don't forget to be really loyal to yourself is something that I tell myself. Like, do the things that have worked. Don't just throw everything out and just fall into the same habits. Be intentional about that. Choose the things and be really loyal to what has been working for you. And that will help you to be able to show up for others as we are looking to make those connections.
Was it a no on your kitchen table?
Yeah, that's a no.
Okay. All right.
The Lisa Show is a production of BYU Radio, and you can find everything you need on the BYU Radio app, where you can listen on demand. If you want to find us on Sirius XM, just go over to channel 143.
Find and subscribe to the Lisa Show podcast.
On tomorrow's show, we're going to learn how we can protect the wildlife in our own neighborhoods.
Thank you for making the Lisa Show a part of your day.